Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Nasiri, and normally I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today is a special skills episode with Stanford's Maggie Neal about how to negotiate.
But secondly, what also happens is that because when we talk about a battle, that sort of the next thing that comes to mind is, did I win or did I lose? And sometimes we get so caught up in winning in a negotiation that we forget or lose sight of what it is we are trying to achieve in that interaction.
Well, first, some context for this interview. In the 275 plus interviews with military veterans about their civilian career that I've conducted, one of the biggest challenges that I hear about from guests is around interviewing, salary negotiation, and sales in general. Two reasons that are often cited are, first of all, that veterans have little to no practice with this while they're in the military. And second of all, there's a culture of advocating for one's subordinates, but not oneself. Examples are that people talk about saying we and not I, or I will speak about what my team accomplished, but not what I accomplished. Another thing that I've observed is that because we have this culture of service, of putting other before oneself, we tend to minimize as veterans our own needs, which can be disadvantageous in a negotiation. Maggie, while not a veteran herself, is a world-renowned authority on negotiations. I am so grateful that she graciously provided us with her time for this episode. She has taught negotiations for over 24 years at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. She's authored over 70 articles and top publications about negotiation, and she is the author of multiple books, all of which are listed in the show notes for this episode, and I highly recommend that you check them out. This interview is a must-listen-to episode for veterans in any career path. As always, at beyondtheuniform.org, in the show notes, you'll find show notes for this episode with links to everything we discuss, as well as a text transcript thanks to Kathleen Dillon. And special thanks to username PFC Doyle, who back in 2017 on Apple Podcasts wrote, "Important information for anyone making the transition to civilian life from the service. We need more podcasts like this one." Thank you, PFC Doyle. I know it was 2 years ago that you wrote that on Apple Podcasts, but it's still paying dividends. And thanks to all of you who have left positive reviews on Apple Podcasts. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Maggie Neal. Well, joining me today in Palo Alto, California, my guest is Maggie Neal. Maggie, thank you so much for making the time for us.
Sure, Justin. It's great to be part of this.
So for listeners, I have a link to Maggie's full bio in the show notes at beyondtheuniform.org, but I wanted to give you a very, very, very abbreviated sense of who she is and what she's done. She is the Adams Distinguished Professor of Management Emerita. She has been a professor at Stanford University for nearly 24 years, where her research includes bargaining and negotiation, distributed work groups, and team composition learning and performance. She is the author of over 70 articles on these topics and multiple books, including Getting More of What You Want. Previous to Stanford, she was a professor at the Kellogg Graduate School of Management for 8 years. She holds a PhD, 2 Masters of Science degrees, and a Bachelor of Science. So Maggie, maybe to start things off, could you give listeners a little bit of a sense of your experience when it comes to negotiation?
Well, I think what's most important to your listeners is my experience when it comes to teaching people about how to negotiate. And for that, most people walk into a negotiation with a completely wrong mindset. The most common mindset that people have with negotiation is that it's a battle. And that battle is characterized by, I'm going to try to get stuff from you that you don't want me to have. And I'm going to try to keep you from getting my stuff. And if that's how you characterize negotiation, you're already in an uphill climb. And the reason is because when you characterize negotiation as battle, at least two things happen. It could be more, but at least two. Number one is that mindset becomes the filter through which you evaluate all of your counterpart's behavior. And because they are the other, they are the enemy, then you interpret their behavior in the worst possible way, the most malevolent way. But secondly, what also happens is that because when we talk about a battle, that sort of the next thing that comes to mind is, did I win or did I lose? And sometimes we get so caught up in winning in a negotiation that we forget or lose sight of what it is we are trying to achieve in that interaction. Now, there are certainly negotiations that are absolutely correctly characterized as a battle. But for you, for me, for our listeners, those are relatively rare. The most common negotiations we have are with people with whom we have or have the potential for a relationship. So what happens is you kind of put together this mindset of a battle with people that we see day after day, and then we begin to have to pick and choose who we're going to negotiate with based upon who we're willing to pick a fight with. And so it limits our opportunities to negotiate.
I love what you're highlighting there, because I imagine most listeners, when they think of a negotiation, they think of the Hollywood depiction. They think of the TV glamorized version, which is exactly as you described. It's this us versus them. It's winning and losing. And what you're doing is shifting perspective, that this is completely different. This is completely different than how they might view it.
Yeah.
One thing that I wanted to ask about, and you and I had traded emails about this, but I wanted to ask specifically your thoughts on how veterans might approach negotiation in a way that will help them succeed. And why I think this is so relevant is, first of all, military veterans traditionally have zero experience doing salary negotiation or any sort of negotiation, with some exceptions. And second of all, from so many of the guests on the show, I know that military veterans often have difficulty advocating for themselves. They can advocate for their team. They can advocate for their subordinates. When it comes to speaking up for themselves and really making sure that they're getting what they want, they often fall short. So I'm wondering if you've seen that before, or any thoughts you have on how to approach that.
So interesting, Justin, that you characterize it in that manner, because if you had asked me to characterize how women typically confront negotiation, it would be with exactly those terms. Mm-hmm. Women negotiate exceedingly well for others, but they are terrible at negotiating for themselves. And part of the reason that I have moved my perspective in negotiation to this notion that negotiation is not a battle. Mm. What it is collaborative problem solving. Is for exactly the reason that you just mentioned. Because what happens is, for people who don't want to advocate for themselves, right, basically getting, for women, there's a pushback, there's a backlash for that. For men, less so. But still, if you're used to sort of an environment where there's command and control, there's a hierarchy, then negotiating, being an advocate for yourself, runs counter to that. And so, in many respects, the perspective that I'm taking actually responds dead on to the kind of challenges that veterans face. Mm. Number one, and let me kind of highlight what I mean when I talk about a collaborative problem-solving perspective. Because too many people, when they hear those terms, think, oh, right, I know what she's talking about. That's that win-win perspective where at the end of the negotiation, we're all doing group hugs and there's rainbows everywhere. And that's not what I'm talking about. So there are three criteria. The first criteria is that at the end of the negotiation, I, the protagonist in this negotiation, am better off than my status quo, better off than my alternative, clearly better off than had I not negotiated. Now that may seem like a low bar, and yet every one of us has, probably more times than we care to admit, negotiated. And at the second before we said yes, there was that little voice in the back of our heads that said, walk away. Mm. We didn't. Rather, we privileged the yes over the quality of the deal. So number one is, I need to be made better off. Number two, because there is no command and control in negotiation, you see, I cannot force you to say yes. All that I can do is to present proposals to you where you think it is in your interest to say yes, and we agree on a common course of action. Now, that interdependence requires that when I make proposals, that from your perspective, my counterpart, you have to at least see those proposals as keeping you whole or perhaps making you better off. And so part of the challenge is, because otherwise, why would you say yes? You see, I need to be able to answer the question in every negotiation. Why would my counterpart say yes to this proposal? And if I can't answer that question, I'm not prepared for the negotiation. And third, and most importantly, and this is really the distinguishing characteristic, not only do I need to know my counterpart, their preferences, their interests, their problems, their challenges, to be able to craft a proposal that from their perspective at least keeps them whole or perhaps makes them better off. But what I must also do when I pitch that proposal is I'm going to frame that proposal as a solution to a problem that my counterpart has. Too often we get caught up in the negotiation thinking, I want that dollar value, I want that outcome, I. And that really is characterized in that first component. But by the time I'm pitching that proposal to you, I'm going to frame that as a solution to a problem that you have. There are two big challenges with this perspective. Number one, it takes a lot more preparation. And preparation is actually one of the critical aspects in negotiation. It's what distinguishes successful negotiators from their less successful counterparts. I've got to understand you. I've got to understand what motivates you. I've got to understand what the challenges and hurdles are for you. And then I need to be creative and figure out how that proposal that I'm making can answer a question that you have. Now, the good news is people tell you their problems. And rather than simply letting those words kind of just flow behind you, you should use those that language. You should basically listen carefully to how people characterize the challenges, why they're at the table with you at the moment, right? And then use that language as part of the way that you characterize or frame your proposal.
I love that. I mean, what I'm hearing in that is a certain degree of self-knowledge, of knowing what the person wants, knowing what they're going to get if they don't negotiate. But I love this aspect. To me, it seems like you're talking about an extreme amount of empathy for the person with whom you're negotiating. And for listeners who may have not negotiated before, I would challenge you that in your role, especially managing people in the military, you have had to have that empathy. You've had to often sell policies coming from the top to your subordinates. You've had to understand what's in it for them. You've had to do all of these things that Maggie's talking about. And the last thing I'll call out for listeners is, I love, Maggie, how you're talking about how important it is to do one's homework. And I think that a lot of listeners, they really thrive with tenacity and resilience and ability to wake up early and discipline and get things done. And so even if you haven't negotiated before, I know that you have an incredible work ethic, and that's going to be an asset in a negotiating situation.
Absolutely, because at the end of the day, the better prepared you are, the more likely the outcome is going to be in your favor.
What about the first place that my mind goes to, or the first experience that I think many listeners will have with negotiations, is salary negotiating. And I'm wondering, in that situation, how do they view it with the employer? Like, in that case, what is it? What's in it for the employer to pay them more or provide them more vacation or whatever it is that they're trying to angle for?
So I recently had a request to do a program for women in management at Stanford. It's a MBA Women's Alliance group. And they said, we wanted you to talk about negotiating salary. So, you know, I said, okay. So when I opened the talk, the title of the talk was Negotiating Salary and Other Strategic Mistakes That People Make. And so they looked at me like, wait a minute, how is it a mistake to negotiate salary? I said, well, here's the problem. When you're negotiating salary, this is a single issue. It's really hard to turn that into a problem-solving perspective. And if you happen to be a female, the biggest amount of backlash comes with a single zero sum, like salary, issue, right? So, and what we know empirically from our research in negotiation is that negotiating one issue at a time or negotiating a single issue destroys value. Mm. So the first thing I would say is, number one, don't negotiate a single issue. Don't negotiate salary. What you want to negotiate is a package. Mm. And a package, you want to think about this as you're not just negotiating salary. What you're negotiating is your compensation package. And that is a multi-issue negotiation. And yes, salary is in there, but that's not the only thing, right? It may be a whole lot of other issues, other resources that can help you do your job better. And in many respects, unless you're old like me and you're looking at your last job, not your first job, you really want to prepare yourself for the next promotion, for the next opportunity. So what are the resources that you need in that negotiation that will help you be better prepared for the promotion and the additional resources that come with that promotion, or another job, another set of competencies? What do you need for the next step? Now, I'm not saying more money is not better than less, so don't get confused. I think more money is better than less. Most everybody else does as well. But the issue is, in the trajectory of your career, having more or less salary at the moment may be dwarfed in its impact by the resources that your organization provides to you. So that's why I suggest, because in fact, in order to create value, in order to problem solve, you've got to have multiple issues. And think about this. If we do a single issue negotiation, there's clearly going to be a winner and clearly going to be a loser. And so even if you do okay, you're probably still not going to feel good about the outcome. So what if we negotiate a package of resources? We craft a package that reflects the unique contributions and the unique desires that my company has for me and that I have for my interaction with the company. And we negotiate that package. Salary may be in it, resources that might help me get additional education, resources that might, for example, allow me to work from home. You know, whatever the dimensions are that in that particular job will make you a better employee. From your perspective, that is making you a better person, a better, more educated, more competent worker. What are those things that you need? And then negotiate the package. And the bottom line is that if you negotiate a single issue like salary and you don't get it, it's kind of hard to characterize that in any kind of positive way. But what if you negotiate a package and you get 5 out of 6 of the issues that you want? Yeah, you may not have gotten salary, maybe. But maybe what you got was an equity position that you hadn't even thought about, which might actually be more beneficial to you in the long run than salary.
I think that's so wonderful. And what I appreciate about that is so many listeners I know, when they're thinking of their first job out of the military, they really zero in on one thing and one thing only, and that is, what is my annual salary? And I think what you're doing is you're zooming us back. You're looking at this holistically. There's titles, vacation. I love the education piece. There's so many different variables. And by taking that package approach, I think that, first of all, is a great way to reorient them to what matters to them and understanding what really matters to their family and them and their decision-making. But it also, like you said, it makes it more possible for both sides to feel good about the final outcome. That's wonderful.
See, that's one of the things that you really need to understand when you think about your counterpart. And that is, you see, if we're just doing salary, it's really hard not to make this out to be a battle. And there are some things that for many companies are easy to give if people ask for them. And there are some things that are really hard to give. So for example, when I was associate dean at Stanford, at the business school, it was really hard for me to make big changes in salary because the provost, the senior academic officer of the institution, had set limits on what I could do. it wasn't that I was trying to be, you know, sort of get people for the cheapest amount of money. It was that I didn't have that authority. But what did I have? I had the authority to give summer support. I had the authority to give research grants. I had the authority to do lots of things that would help a faculty member become more productive. I had all that control, and people kept saying, but no, but my salary. And I'm going, think about summer support. Think about this. Think about that. And they're like, no, I want more salary. And it's like, you're an idiot, okay? You need to think long-term and big picture. What's going to make you a better researcher? Which that's, you know, at Stanford, if you're not a good, I mean, you can be a great teacher. You got to be at least a good researcher. And so you got to do both. And what's going to help you do that? Because most of us, when we get a job at Stanford, we'd like to stay at Stanford. And so you need to have that success in order to have that option.
It really speaks to what you said earlier about the creativity involved in negotiations. And that's also one where I think most people don't associate, I think they associate negotiations with boldness and courage and hard line and all these other things. But creativity, as you're describing it, really plays a big role of thinking, what might this person value? What else could we bring to the table? And I also really appreciate what you're saying about taking the long view in one's career, and not just, it's not just about in this moment what you're making, but what will set you up for success in the future. What are the resources that you need to really succeed? I think that's a great perspective.
And I think what that does is it allows you to craft a proposal that reflects your unique position, your unique perspective. What do you need in order to be effective, right? And by the way, what I would say is when you're planning and preparing, invoke your networks, figure out, you know, from your counterpart's perspective, what's going to be easy for them to say yes to and what's going to be hard for them to say yes to. And you can do that by, you know, thinking about, well, who are the other folks that I know in this organization? Who are the other folks that I know in similar organizations? And say, okay, talk to them. How hard was it to negotiate X, Y, and Z? Give me some advice. Use your networks to help you gather information.
That's great. And I was going to ask about preparation. And so you're kind of speaking to different tactics to get to understand the person you're negotiating with and the situation. Any other advice for listeners about how to prepare for a negotiation or things to do prior to entering into that conversation?
Yeah, there's a whole lot. In fact, I have two entire chapters in my book on preparation. So I certainly would refer you to the book. But absent that, you first need to understand your perspective. And as a starting point, there are three parameters that are absolutely critical for you to have control of before you start a negotiation. And the first one is, you need to understand what happens to you in the event that there is no deal. So what happens if this negotiation ends in an impasse? What are your alternatives? And, you know, for many folks, you have multiple alternatives, right? You could be having multiple job position offers, right? So that's great, because whenever you have multiple offers, it's a lot easier to negotiate because you feel more powerful. And the research confirms that. The research on alternatives, there's been hundreds of studies. And while they're all nuanced and slightly different, the general finding is he or she with the better alternative on average walks away with more. Mm. So that's great if you have a good set of alternatives. The challenge for most people is that we get anchored to our alternative. We say to ourselves the equivalent of, you know, if my alternative is here, sort of in this range, if I can just exceed that alternative, wherever that alternative is, I'm doing okay. And if that's how you characterize your options, you have just anchored yourself. You have just limited yourself. You've limited the upside, because now you're focusing on just beating your alternative. Your alternative should not be seen as a standard by which you judge acceptability. Hmm. Because you could have drawn a bad alternative. Maybe you're much better than that. or maybe you're much worse than that, right? So either way, but what you should think about is your alternative is not a standard of acceptability. It's like a safety net. So imagine yourself a trapeze artist, and you are about to, you actually engage in a performance before a live audience, and in the middle of that performance, something happens, and you end up in the safety net. Now, you're not going to judge that performance as acceptable or good. You didn't plan on being in the safety net. It's not a good outcome. But if you are in the safety net, you're really glad it's there. Mm. And that's how I want you to think about your alternatives. That's number one, your alternative. Number two, your reservation price. That bottom line, that point of indifference. You see, when I say point of indifference, a lot of people smile and nod. But what I mean by that is, you are so, if you are at your bottom line, you are so indifferent that you'd be willing to flip a coin. And if it lands heads, you walk away. And if it lands tails, you say yes. That's how indifferent you should be. Your reservation price is a bright line standard that you do not violate. That sounds really easy and simple. It's really hard to do. And the reason it's so hard to do is because we so privilege a yes as a standard of success in a negotiation. We see that when we walk away, we have somehow failed. And that mindset pushes us to accept deals that make us worse off because we don't have the agency. We don't give ourselves the agency to walk away. That's number two. And number three, if all you think about is your worst possible deal you could say yes to, or your safety net, your alternatives, then you are anchoring yourself to the bottom of the distribution. You have basically literally got to leverage up your expectations about what is possible by setting an aspiration. An aspiration is an optimistic assessment of what you could achieve in this particular negotiation. So assessing your situation, your experience and your knowledge and your alternatives and your counterpart and their situation and their knowledge and their abilities and their alternatives. If things went really well for you, what could you achieve? Because while you will rarely achieve your aspiration, setting that aspiration on average results in higher performance than if you focus on your alternative or on your reservation price.
That's so wonderful. I hope that listeners rewind and listen to that segment over and over again and dig deeper in the books that we'll have in the resources section. I think that that trapeze illustration is incredible. It is amazing to think how we view that the worst case scenario as acceptable versus like, hey, you're glad if you're in it, but let's not have that be where your sights are on. And I love where you ended with this thought of like just really setting your sights high, like not constantly looking at that anchor, but setting your sights on what's ahead. So I think that there's so much wisdom in that. I appreciate your going into detail on that.
Well, let me just highlight that one of the most powerful psychological forces in the human psyche is the impact of expectations on our behavior. So if you have low expectations, your performance will be low. If you have high expectations, on average, your performance will be better. And so why not intentionally set expectations to leverage that knowledge?
I can see why psychology has played such an influence in your background, because this is it is those little things of realizing that you will rise to those expectations and trying to set those high, not just in the negotiation but beyond in your performance. And I also love what you said about the bias we have to want to say yes, and it made me think of the adage that I've heard of poker players, how they only play 2 out of 10 hands. Like they're constantly passing on opportunities. They're not playing that often. And yet when I think of a negotiation, you're right. Like my bias is I have to reach a deal. I have to get to yes. I mean, there's even a book, Getting to Yes. It's like
biased. Oh, Justin, stop. I see. I think that Getting to Yes, the title of that book, and that book was written in 1981.
Yep.
Okay. But the problem is, it was an awesome marketing title because when you hear that title, you don't forget. Let me compare my first book on negotiation. The title, Negotiating Rationally, right? In your mind. But as a conceptual title, Getting to Yes is simply wrong because the goal of a negotiation is not to get to yes. The goal of a negotiation is to get a good deal. And to get a good deal, you have to leave open the option that you can walk away. Because think about this. If you are confronting a negotiation where at the end of the day, the deal is bad for you, if you say yes to that, if you privilege agreement, you know exactly what you're going to get, that bad deal. But you don't know what might happen if, with all graciousness and goodwill, you say to your counterpart, I would really like to make a deal happen here. I would really like to come to work for this organization, but I simply cannot do so under these conditions. And be willing to walk away. Now, it may be the case that you learn a lot from that. You learn a lot. Maybe you learn that that person has a great set of alternatives and you aren't it. Maybe you will walk away. But the other possibility is that they may really want you. And so they may be willing to make additional concessions in order to get you into the organization. But you will never learn that if you say yes to their first offer.
And I'm aware as you're saying that, and I just want to call out for a listener, is it seems to me that most listeners have an even stronger bias towards yes. Many of you have been put in situations where you have to overcome incredible obstacles to achieve an objective or accomplish an mission. And in essence, you are biased towards yes being the only acceptable answer. And so I would just challenge listeners to be hyper vigilant and aware of that, that everyone has this bias towards yes, and do your military service, you may be even more biased towards that. It might be something you have to fight even stronger than the average person, or be at least more aware of in these situations.
Well, here's what I would suggest, in addition to what you've just said, Justin. I would say you need to reframe what your mission is. So you're not to get to yes. Your mission is to get a good outcome for you and an outcome that your counterparts, because they're not going to say yes to a deal they can't live with, right? So it's got to be at least keeps them whole or perhaps makes them better off. That's your mission. Your mission is not to simply get a yes from your counterpart.
That's great. I love that reframing. One thing I was wondering about is, and I wonder for women in business if this is true too, but I'm trying to think of, are there ways where listeners can practice some of the things you're talking about? Is there ways where they can get some experience prior to actually sitting in for their first real life live ammunition negotiation?
Sure, there are lots of ways. Number one, have your partner or your spouse play the role. And have them, you know, sort of try to keep making this into a zero-sum battle, and you keep bringing it up into a package and problem solving. So that's one. I mean, my colleagues and I, my co-author, for example, in the book, when we have a really important negotiation that we're gonna undertake, we actually practice and set up a script for how we're going to respond. And we try to figure out all of the kind of the decision nodes that are going to have to come through so that we can be prepared for them. Because once you're prepared, then, you know, when they throw you what they think is a curveball and you're like, I already predicted that one. So here's the answer to that, right? You're so much more in control. And so that's the number one. Number two, take opportunities to negotiate. You don't have to wait for the big, you know, compensation package negotiation. When you are trying to get your kids to do stuff that they don't want to do. That's a negotiation. So use some of the, think about this as a problem solving perspective. Perhaps you could force your adolescent to do something, but the pushback and the blowback is terrible. So think about a problem solving perspective. How can you create an outcome that for them, they're at least kept whole or perhaps made better off? Engage in, act as if this is how you interact. That, see, every time you have a meeting, every time you have a request that you really don't want to invoke command and control, then you're in a negotiation. Practice this until it becomes second nature, because you always need to be thinking, okay, what's stopping my counterpart from saying yes to this? Whether that's my 14-year-old son or my co-author, it doesn't make any difference. What's stopping them? Because they have to voluntarily walk that path of agreement with you if there's going to be a negotiated outcome. And so practice, practice, practice. And then in these situations where even if you kind of screw up, you'll have another opportunity, because let me tell you, your adolescent will give you more opportunity to negotiate.
I think that's great. I know so many listeners do have kids, and it seems to me you're encouraging almost just adopting this as a mindset, almost as a way of being, of thinking creatively, not thinking so much about zero sum and us versus them, but entering into conversations with one's partner and entering into conversations with one's kids or at retail stores or whatever it might be, like trying this out in low stakes environments. And I love what you're talking about practicing. I know in episode 180, we had Andy Chan on the show, who was at Stanford previously, with the Career Management Center. And what you said reminded me of similar thoughts about interview preparation, where you're literally thinking through, what are all the questions I could be asked? What are all the responses or the stories that I can bring to bear? And I'm sure for some listeners that might sound maybe robotic or rehearsed, but if you're prepared and you prepare enough, you can, it's more conversational. You don't have to be thinking about what you're going to be saying. You can think more about reading the other person's expressions or the delivery, or it's more natural. So I love that thought of the role playing is such a critical element in preparation.
And think what you're doing, how you're benefiting your children. Because if you get them into a mindset of, you know what, if I solve a problem for you that makes me better off, we don't have to have conflict. We can actually be collaborative.
That's wonderful. I'm wondering, some of the listeners had sent in questions. Some of them are not applicable, but one of the questions that comes to mind is how to handle, and this is more related to, I'm imagining, salary negotiation, but when the person asks as part of the application process or the interview process, either what you made previously or, hey, what are you expecting to make in this role?
Okay, number one, if they're asking you, what are you expecting to make, you should have an answer. This is part of your preparation. So you need to understand the parameters of the position, because that's going to help you figure out what the resources are that you can request. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, what they're asking you is, if, when they say, you know, what is your previous salary, they're in effect trying to gauge your reservation price. And one of the things is that, quite frankly, I think that it is illegal in many states to ask that question. But I suspect that your listeners are across the country, and in some states it's completely legal. If somebody asks that question, then maybe what you should do is answer it. I would not recommend that if you have other alternatives, because basically your reservation price is the single most strategic piece of information in your negotiation. So to share the number that they would, that it was your, basically, why would you move and take less, right? But what's also true is, don't lie. Absolutely do not exaggerate. And think about being strategic into when you'll share that information and when you won't. I'll come back to that in just a second. But the Bottom line is, you may want to have a conversation, change the question. So you're probably not simply applying for exactly the same job that you already have, but rather you're applying for a different job with expanded responsibilities, with expanded scope or breadth of control. And so the question is, while it's interesting that you want to know what my salary was, and I can certainly understand why you'd want to know that, one of the things that I'm wondering is, you know, basically, what is this job worth? And how much do I, you know, and that's the notion of what do you expect to get? You need to have that answer. You need to say to them, well, let's have a conversation about this job, not my past job. Because my past job, it's basically sunk. It's a sunk cost. I'm there. I'm not applying for that job. I'm applying for this job. And this has greater scope, greater span of control, more responsibility, a different job, right? So let's talk about what this job is worth. Again, sometimes I can tell you that I have strategically told my employer what my last compensation was. And why did I do that? Because in my preparation, I realized that he, in this case it was a he was about to make me an offer for less than I was currently making because he had done no homework. And what I did not want was for that number to leave his mouth, because I didn't want him to be anchored or feel embarrassed because he hadn't done his homework. And so when we started having this discussion about my compensation package, he said, I said, before we get into the details, I said, I am concerned. And he said, what are you concerned about? And I said, well, I'm concerned that you haven't asked me for any information about my current compensation, because I knew that his anchor was what he paid previous full professors. And I knew that was too low. So he said, you're right, I haven't. What is your compensation currently at your previous school? And so I told him, and I said, I'm happy to provide you with any evidence that you need to justify my last salary letter, a letter from my dean, whatever you need. And there was silence on the other end of the phone. And I said, I guessed right, didn't I? And he said, yes, you did. And I said, okay, so I think maybe what we should do right now is take a break. You've gotten some new information, which changes, I think it changes you, what you're expecting to negotiate. I said, so why don't we just set another time and have this conversation later? To which he responded, what would it take to get you here? To which I had an answer.
That's so incredible, because it's such a great example of you. The sense I get from the people asking these questions is they're dreading that question. And I love you're giving an example where you're eager to provide it. And it really calls back to, you know, one of your main points about the importance of preparation, of having these numbers on the tip of your tongue and knowing exactly what your counterpart is thinking. It seems like in this situation, you knew their situation better than they did. You knew more about what they wanted than they did. It's really incredible.
Well, I think one of the things that we know from research and negotiation is that the more powerful you are in a negotiation relative to your counterpart, the less prepared. So I had made a prediction which was accurate, given I also knew that I'd not been asked. But I also said, even if I had not, you know, even if I didn't have that information whether I was asked or not, I would have predicted that my counterpart, who was, you know, a high status person, was not going to do their homework. They have the notion of sort of how, if we make her an offer to come to this institution, of course she will say yes. And my response was, of course we will talk about this.
That's great. I know we're running short on time. I wanted to ask just about resources. And I'm imagining this is your own, but I'm curious if there are if there's a book in particular that you would recommend to a listener who is interested in digging deeper into this, or it doesn't have to be a book. It could be an article, a magazine, podcast, whatever it might be. How might they take this further?
So a couple things. One is you're absolutely right. I think my book is awesome. So I look at my book. It's called Getting More of What You Want, How the Secrets of Economics and Psychology Can Help You Negotiate Anything in Business and in Life. Co-authored with an economist. So I have a psychological background. He has an economics background. And we merge the perspectives, which is what makes the book unique. There's also a website called gettingmoreofwhatyouwant.com. You're welcome. Any of your listeners are welcome to go there. There are lots of podcasts and articles, and this podcast will eventually show up there. Research that we've done, video clips, all sorts of stuff. I just throw everything up there. And for your listeners who are specialists in web design, do not tell me that my website is disgusting and awful. I use it as a public service. So I just throw stuff up there. You guys are welcome to go through it and see what you care about, what is of use to you. It's completely available.
Thank you. And for listeners, I'll add links to both of those, Getting More of What You Want, as well as the website in the show notes for this episode. Well, I always like to leave the last question open-ended and for you to take however you'd like. And that is just kind of, before we wrap up, is there anything we haven't covered that you want to make sure listeners know? Or is there any final words that you'd like to leave listeners with?
Yeah, I think I'm going to do the final words as opposed to anything we haven't covered, because I can speak for days on negotiation. But what I think is important to understand is, if you change the conversation, if you conceptualize this as collaborative problem solving, you see, think about me. I taught negotiation. I do research in negotiation. I have written books in negotiation. And whenever I got involved in a situation at Stanford, my counterparts would go, "You're negotiating with me, right?" And then they would get all armored up and ready for a fight. And I'm like, no, I don't negotiate with you. We problem solve. Because I don't need them to get ready to sort of, you know, I don't need them to be all armored up and sort of real, you know, interpreting my behaviors in the worst possible way. And so I said, look, I may negotiate with other people, but with you, we problem solve. And thinking that perspective, changing your mindset to one of problem solving, because many of the questions that your listeners will have, and many of the enduring concerns that they have, or because it's so hard to make that transition from negotiation as battle to negotiation as collaborative problem solving. But you cannot force an outcome. All you can do is present proposals where your counterpart thinks that they will at least be kept whole or perhaps made better off. And once you do that, so many more things become open to negotiation.
Well, Maggie, thank you so much for your time today. I have learned a lot. I know our listeners will as well. And I know how many demands there are on your time. And for listeners, I shot an email to Maggie. She responded right away and made time for this. And as you look at her bio in the show notes, you will notice there is no shortage of ways for her to spend her time and no shortage of demands on it. So thank you so much for the time and perspective today.
Thanks, Justin. It's been a delight.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Quick couple admin points. We release brand new episodes every single Monday and Thursday. Those are usually recorded about a month or so before they go live. And every Monday and Thursday, we have an interview, usually almost always with a military veteran about their civilian career. More and more, we're starting to add in experts who may not be veterans, but may have some expertise that will help the military veteran community. Saturdays, I typically post more of a behind the scenes episode, which is a free form format. I try to use what I'm calling a mullet format. And by that, I mean business up front, party in the back, talking through admin points, professional topics related to the podcast. It might be a conversation I had that week. It might have been an interview I had that week, but just trying to share things that are top of mind that may help you in more of a free form, straight from the heart format. And then the party in the back is the personal side of things, just kind of more free-flowing thoughts on life, on improving oneself, just kind of whatever's going on in life and trying to be authentic and honest about those things as well. Special thanks. We have an all-volunteer army of people behind Beyond the Uniform making this possible. We do this on our lunch breaks, on our evenings, on our weekends, because we love the military community. We want to give back. We want to make a difference. We want that as part of the purpose in our life that we valued in the military. So special thanks to Steve Bain. Steve does pretty much everything. He helps secure guests. He does our newsletter. He keeps the reels rolling and keeps me sane. Kathleen Dillon, the first person to join our team, she writes text transcripts of every single episode. It's wild. She keeps up with two of these a week despite a demanding career and education right now. But those transcripts help us get more SEO value, helps her audience more. Andrew Woolridge is our data guru. He helps us understand the numbers, which is the easiest way for us to figure out how we can better support you, and adds kind of the data oversight for that. Rick Healy does all of our social media. He is gaining more and more of an audience for us by getting our videos, getting our podcasts out on social channels. The best way to stay in contact with us is if you go to beyondtheuniform.org, there is a newsletter. You'll have a little pop-up that comes up. You can put your email in. We email twice per month. We try to be respectful, but it is a great way to get appraised of upcoming events, upcoming interviews, promos where companies are giving discounts to Beyond the Uniform listeners, and more. This does cost money to put on. We are committed to not charging veterans directly, and the way that we kind of offset costs is through corporate sponsors. So if you know of a company that would like to get in front of a military audience and their families, that's one way that we can both add value to our members, but also offset the costs of Beyond the Uniform and give us a little bit of budget to start expanding what we're doing. So that's the best way you can help us. If that's not something that you can do, a positive review on iTunes is greatly appreciated. Have a wonderful week. We will be back Monday, Thursday, and Saturday with more interviews. And keep up the listening. Take care.